Back to the JT The Brick Show with your host for today, Vinny Bonsignor, on Raider Nation Radio 920 AM. It's the JT The Brick Show, broadcasting live from the Finley Cadillac Performance Studio.
Raiders bring a blitz. He takes up off the middle, and he's wrapped up from behind. Max Crosby!
Your silver and black home to sound off for over 25 years.
Open at the 35, racing to the 20, 10, touchdown Raiders!
And now, here's JT The Brick.
You know, the young guys have done really well. The guys that we chose in the draft have all made a mark at some point and show that they're deserve being here. You know, it looks like a really good class all the way through, both offensive linemen, both defensive linemen. They participated and rolled in with the twos for the most part. Those guys, they held their own. Ashton had an excellent camp, but Dante and Jack, they did their stuff. You know, it's a good-looking group, and the idea is to force those guys to play early and make them have to play. And that, to do that well, you have to ask them to do things they're good at. If you just ask them to try to do everything that a veteran knows, they're going to falter and they're not going to be able to show themselves. But if you do it in a progressive manner that gives them a chance to show, then by the time we get to midseason, those guys can be regulars for us. And so this is not a new process. This is the way I've done it with rookies and freshmen and the whole thing for a long time. And it just depends on how well you orchestrate what you ask them to do. And if they can find success, then their confidence builds, and then before you know it, you got a regular. And that just helps our depth and helps us stay competitive.
Well, there it is. Don't take my word for it. Don't take your word for it. Take Pete Carroll's word for it. The Raiders' rookie class during the offseason program, all the way back to when they first got into the building, and then rookie minicamp, and obviously during OTAs and minicamp that involved veteran players. This Raiders rookie class definitely showed Pete Carroll, John Spytek, the coaching staff, Chip Kelly, a little bit of something, right? Enough for them to expect that there's going to be players from this rookie class that contribute pretty quickly. We get, obviously, that Ashton Jeanty is going to be probably a focal point of this offense, and rightfully so. But there's 10 other players of this rookie class that the Raiders are counting on in one form or fashion or one way or another. And many of those players, probably a lot sooner than most people would have suspected. I'm Vinny Bonsignor. I'm sitting in for JT The Brick. I'm here all week as JT takes some well-deserved time off, 12 to 2 o'clock, and truly appreciate JT having the confidence in me to sit in for him. This is a pretty big chair, and I don't take it lightly. Don't take it for granted. I certainly really appreciate that opportunity. Got a great show for you lined up at 12:30. Howard Balzer, the great NFL writer who has a huge say in everything Hall of Fame related. He also covers the Arizona Cardinals. The Raiders will face the Cardinals in the preseason, but Howard always has his finger on the pulse of the NFL, especially as it relates to the Hall of Fame. We'll talk to him at 12:30. And then at 1:30, our good friend Trista Crick will be in. She's in town in Las Vegas covering the NBA. The NBA Summer League in Las Vegas gets started tomorrow. That's right, Cooper Flagg, the first pick overall, facing Bronny James and the Lakers tomorrow at 5 o'clock over at Thomas and Mack Center. I will definitely be there. Looking forward to that. Trista will join us talking about all the craziness that's going on in the NBA right now from what looks to be a really good young rookie class along with Cooper Flagg. But also all the moving and shaking that's going on with the NBA and where all of that stands. There's some players that have been bought out, veteran players that can help teams pretty early. So we'll get into all of that with Trista Crick. But I'm asking the question to you, our listeners, and you can reach me at 702-365-9200, whether you call me on the phone or text us. What are your expectations for this Raiders rookie class? What do you feel is feasible for this 11-man class that John Spytek and Pete Carroll and the entire scouting department put together for the Raiders? I'll just name them all off. Ashton Jeanty, Jack Besh, Darian Porter, Caleb Rogers, Charles Grant, Dante Thornton, Tanika Hemingway, J.J. Pegues, Tommy Mellott, Cam Miller, Cody Lindenberg. Look, those names became synonymous with the Raiders in April, and it was a heralded group. It was a big, voluminous group, 11 players from this draft that the Raiders added to this team. There were expectations and excitement during draft weekend, but now the closer we get to them actually reporting, and last I checked, that was next week. Yes, the Raiders rookies report for their first official training camp in the NFL next week on July 17th. They'll be joined by the veterans on July 22nd, and then it gets going full steam ahead on July 23rd when the Raiders open their first training camp practice over at their practice facility in Henderson. There's headliners in this group. There's core vet players. There's meat and potato guys that I think are going to play solid roles this year, whether it's on special teams, in rotation, pushing for starting jobs along the offensive line. There's going to be some development guys that might not pay off this year, but down the line could really reap some benefits for the Raiders. But again, I ask the question to you guys, what do you feel is viable for this rookie class? When you talk about Ashton Jeanty, I think he's going to be a guy that bursts onto this scene. I think he's going to be a player that lines up right alongside many of the other great running backs that came into this league at that stage of the draft. He was a sixth pick overall. We've heard some names. It's so funny to me watching and listening to Pete Carroll talk about Ashton Jeanty and the times that we've talked to him about Ashton Jeanty. And you know, Pete Carroll has been around football for a long, long time. That kind of goes without saying. He's 73 years old, 73 years young, I should say, because he's definitely a young 73, and he's got a lot to give and a lot to offer for many, many years to come. But let's be honest. You know, this is a coach that literally coached with Bud Grant, the great Minnesota Vikings former coach. Remember Bud Grant, the late, great Bud Grant? An iconic coach in the NFL. And when you think about Pete Carroll coaching alongside Bud Grant, that just tells you how long he's been in this game. So it's always interesting when Pete Carroll goes into that great, deep, unbelievably lengthy memory bank that he has working with players over the years, whether he coached with them, whether he scouted them, whether he game planned against them. This is a coach that's seen some of the greats of the greats of the greats that have come down the pike over many, many decades. So he has a memory bank unlike almost any coach that's a contemporary coach in the NFL, been there, seen that. So it's interesting to me when he starts talking about Ashton Jeanty and he starts getting into that area where he's going, you know, he reminds me, and I could see him stop because probably in his mind, look, don't want to put too much pressure on young Ashton. He's already coming in with enough accolades, with enough expectations. You don't want to start naming some of the names that are probably popping up in Pete Carroll's head when he thinks about Ashton Jeanty. And I always try to get into his head to kind of figure out where he's going with that. Because for my money, and I've been around, you know, quite a long time. I put it this way. I remember when Pete Carroll was an assistant coach with the Minnesota Vikings back in the day. So that tells you how long I've been doing this. And when I look at an Ashton Jeanty, when I watched him at Boise State, when I saw him doing his thing against some really good opponents, I know everyone says, well, he played in the Mountain West Conference. Great. Go check out the tape of him tearing up the University of Oregon. Go look at what he did against Penn State when the entire Penn State defense, including some high NFL draft picks, were geared up, schemed up, and coached up, and their entire defense was designed to stop Ashton Jeanty, because no disrespect to Boise State, but he was their show, basically, right? And so when they get to the playoffs and they play a vaunted defense like Penn State and a great with just NFL talent all over the field, their whole objective that night was to stop Ashton Jeanty. He still went over 100 yards in that game. He tore Oregon up. And last time I checked, Oregon was a playoff team. It was at Oregon, and he ran for over a buck 50 in that game, broke a couple long ones. So forget about this is a player that played in the Mountain West. I don't care about that. You know talent when you see talent, right? And you saw what he did against big-time competition. He was an equal opportunity punisher, whether it was the big boys or the level that he played at. The guy can play. So when I see him, when I watch him, I'm not afraid, embarrassed, ashamed, or even hesitant to say, well, he kind of reminds me a little bit of a Barry Sanders. He kind of reminds me a little bit of a Marshall Faulk. I know the Marshawn Lynch comp has been brought up, a guy that when you watch his running style, the his ability to kind of bounce off people, and I think it was 163 tackles that he broke last year. It was whatever it was over 100 tackles that he broke last year at Boise State, which means he's running through tackles, he's bouncing off guys, and he does it with certainly a level of toughness. But there's also a kind of a madness to his style. He's setting dudes up so that when you're going to tackle him, you're a little bit off center, you're a little bit off balance, and so you're not able to wrap him up initially. He knows what he's doing, and I don't think that's not going to happen in the NFL. It's probably not going to be 163 tackles or the crazy number that he had last year in college, but he's going to break tackles. And we saw Marshall Faulk at San Diego State and did not miss a beat when he got to the NFL, was a Hall of Famer and MVP caliber player. Barry Sanders, you know, let's talk about him. He played at Oklahoma State. He wasn't at Oklahoma. He wasn't at, you know, one of the major schools. I mean, Oklahoma State is definitely high up there, but there's a pecking order. We all get it. And Oklahoma State is a little bit further down compared to the Texases and the Oklahomas. But all he did was set records in college football, and of course that translated to the NFL. He was one of the great backs of all time. So when I look at Ashton Jeanty, I'm not hesitant at all in my mind and out of my mouth to start to put him at least in comparison to those guys. Now he has to go out there and do it on the field, and I guess that's the question. What kind of expectations do you have for Ashton Jeanty? Let me know, 702-365-9200. But beyond that, and I feel like he's going to be, provided he stays healthy, which everyone knocks on wood about for all of these players, it's always about health. I think the Raiders understand the caliber of player that they have in Ashton Jeanty, so they're going to set him up for success. They're going to use him. They're going to lean on him. They're going to give him the ball. They're going to hand it to him. They're going to pitch it to him. They're going to throw it to him. They're going to throw it to him downfield. They're going to dump it to him, as a safety valve. They're going to scheme up screen plays to give him the ball. They're going to get the ball in his hands, and they're going to do it often. Why wouldn't you? He's that good. So in your mind, what kind of expectations do you have for Ashton Jeanty? What about Jack Besh? What about Dante Thornton? What about Darian Porter? That's another player that feels like he's on the fast track to get on the field really early. Say what you want about OTAs and minicamp. You can't read everything into what you see in terms of the depth chart and who's lining up where and who's lining up with who. But as the days got stacked up in OTAs and minicamp, and as practice went and practices one after another, you started seeing that Darian Porter was out there with the starters, flat out, period, exclamation point. Darian Porter was one of the starting cornerbacks consistently throughout all the viewing practices that we were allowed to watch, talking about the media. And he looked like he belonged. So if he's on the fast track, if that carries over into training camp and into the regular season, and young Darian Porter, the third round cornerback from Iowa State, is a starter, what kind of expectations do you have for him? What about Caleb Rogers and Charles Grant? You know, maybe it kind of flies by the wayside a little bit on draft week, and everything's going so fast. Those are 2 third-round picks in the offensive line. Those are premium picks. The NFL considers the third round premium picks. And you go talk to John Spytek. You go talk to NFL general managers. And every one of them in the league will tell you that the sweet spot of this draft, this past draft, was in that, 25 to 100 range. Right, they felt like there was going to be great value there, that there were going to be some players that can contribute earlier and sooner rather than later. Well, let's just look at Caleb Rogers and Charles Grant, pick number 98 and 99. Right? 98 and 99. So those are pretty high picks for offensive linemen. That tells me that the Raiders have plans for those two young players. And I like where the offensive line is, in terms of the players that are coming back, in terms of Alex Kappa, who they went out and signed in free agency. You got your Colton Millers and your Dylan Parhams and your Jackson Powers Johnsons and your Alex Kappa and your Jordan Meredith and your DJ Glaze. So those are 6 players right there that I feel give the Raiders, and you know, Thayer Munford coming back as well, a guy that you know has shown that he can play both tackle positions and be a good swing tackle for you. We saw him line up at guard a little bit during OTAs and minicamp. So there's seven players along the offensive line that you feel pretty good about. But the Raiders did invest 2 third-round picks back to back at 98 and 99 in Caleb Rogers and Charles Grant for any old reason other than they feel like these guys have a bright future in the NFL and guys that could be knocking on the door sooner rather than later. And I guess if I played a hunch on that, I would think that Caleb is a little bit further along than Charles Grant. But I only say that because Charles Grant, a left tackle playing at William & Mary, you know, a little bit lower level of football compared to the Texas Tech, which is where Caleb played at. I think, and Charles is a fantastic athlete. He's got a really bright future. I just don't know if that future is right now. And when I say right now, I'm talking about right now. There's a long season. One thing when you cover the NFL, you realize it is a long season, and guys can make strides throughout that season. So where he was in OTAs and minicamp, and he looked like he belonged, let's put it that way. Was he ready to start? I mean, that's a lot. That's a lot to throw out a young player to be a starting tackle in the NFL, especially where he projects to be, which is a left tackle. But come training camp, you know, we'll have some better answers. And look, all you have to do is go back to last year. The Raiders, again, and it always kind of amuses me when some fans are like, the Raiders need to invest in their offensive line. They need to invest draft capital in their offensive line. Well, last two drafts, a second-round pick in Jackson Powers Johnson, a third-round pick in DJ Glaze. That's the 2024 draft class. Both of those players ended up being starters and pretty darn good starters as the year went on. Then this year, I just mentioned it, the two third-round picks, Caleb Rogers and Charles Grant. You go back to 2022. Dylan Parham, drafted in the third round. In fact, that was the first draft pick of the Dave Ziegler draft class or his regime. Dylan Parham, by the way, just turned in his best season as a pro last year. So that's a third-round pick, a second-round pick, and then two more third-round picks over the last, what, 3-4 years or so. That's pretty good draft capital to put into your offensive line. So they are definitely investing in that group, and it's a younger group than it sometimes gets credit for, and I think there's a lot of promise. But my question is, how long before we see Caleb Rogers and Charles Grant? We talked about Dante Thornton, the wide receiver from Tennessee, felt like he was further along, more advanced during the offseason than maybe we thought based on what he had done at Tennessee. What's his role going to be? What expectations do you have for Dante Thornton? And then we always kind of forget about Tanika Hemingway and J.J. Pegues, the two defensive tackles, a fourth-round pick in Tanika Hemingway, and then a sixth-round pick in J.J. Pegues, South Carolina and Mississippi, respectfully. So, you know, you're talking about two players that the Raiders have high hopes for, and as Pete Carroll was talking about in the soundbite, these guys were working their way into the rotation during OTAs and minicamp. So these are two players that, at the very least this year, could work their way into the rotation, and that's important. So we just named 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 players, 8 players, that of those 8 players, I'd say 7 are probably going to see the field a lot earlier than some people think. I'm going to give Charles Grant a little bit more time based on the position that he played or is playing and what's in front of him in that position room at tackle, but then also where he played at William & Mary. I think there's going to be a transition going on there. And then Tommy Mellott, the quarterback from Montana State, who's making the transition to wide receiver. Cam Miller, the quarterback from North Dakota State. Obvious reasons, he's probably very much so on a development track. You got Geno Smith as the established starter, and you got Aiden O'Connell, who I think projects as one of the better or more solid backup quarterbacks in the NFL. But you can't, I mean, Cam Miller is going to be given an opportunity to unseat Aiden O'Connell at some point, whether it's earlier or later, we'll see. He's going to be given the opportunity to rise up the depth chart. And then, of course, Cody Lindenberg, the linebacker from Minnesota. Here's a guy that was steady with the second team defense during OTAs and minicamp to the point where he had the green dot on. He was the guy that was calling the defense as a second team linebacker. So what's his future hold? Again, your thoughts, 702-365-9200, whether you want to give us a call or text us, what are your expectations for this Raiders rookie class? All right, let's get to Ashton Jeanty. I'm just going to throw it out there. I think he runs for 1,300 yards plus, and I think he catches 40 to 45 balls for over 400 yards. So there's 1,700 yards from scrimmage by your rookie running back. Is that something that you would expect? Do you think that he's capable of that? I mean, when you look at the Saquon Barkleys, when you look at recent rookie running backs who have come into the NFL, Zeke from the Dallas Cowboys, Ezekiel Elliott, both of those running backs were in that 1,800 or 2,000 yard mark. Why shouldn't we expect that from Ashton Jeanty? He's, to me, at least as a rookie, he's every bit as good as Ezekiel Elliott was. It remains to be seen. But based on what I saw in college, I don't see that being an issue whatsoever. So if he gets used accordingly, and I expect that Chip Kelly is going to understand, he knows what he's got in Ashton. The great ones always do. And the great ones always step onto the scene and announce themselves really early on. So I'm gonna say between 16 and seven and a high and 1,700 yards plus in terms of yards from line of scrimmage. So we'll see. What about Jack Besh, the wide receiver from TCU? Here's a guy that blew it up at the Senior Bowl. I was there. I don't know how many times I wrote his name down during practices in my notebook. He just kept beating opposing defensive backs, and there were some pretty – put it this way. Everybody that was on the field on the other team's defense got drafted. All of them did, and a lot of them were high draft picks. And Jack Besh did not take a – he was the MVP of the game, for crying out loud. He was probably the MVP to me of practice. This is a guy that was out physicaling people, was getting around people, was getting through people, was catching everything that got thrown his way. He's a tough, physical, tough-minded football player, and I think that he's going to get on the field pretty early. It'll be interesting because of the pecking order that we talked about yesterday. There's some pretty good players that are going to get fed on this football team when you're talking about Brock Bowers, when you're talking about Jakobi Meyers. And where does he fall in that line? But no reason to think that he's not going to have the kind of season that you would expect of a second-round pick. And the guy that I really have my eye on, and I want your thoughts, 702-365-9200, Darian Porter. How excited are you to see Darian Porter? 6'3", you know, like every bit, the 6'3", over 200 pounds that he's listed at, tall, lanky player, long arms. Fantastic athlete. He could run like the wind. He's got quickness. He's got, you know, is able to use his footwork. He's a physical player. He was a special teams demon. It tells you that he's got an intelligence about the game. It tells you that he understands how to get to the football, timeliness of making plays. I'm really curious about Darian Porter and about what he's going to bring to the table and whether or not what we saw in OTAs and minicamp does carry over when the pads go on, because we've seen that too. We've seen guys blow it up during, you know, when they're out there with their shorts and shoulder pads and helmet. It's a little bit of a different game, you know, obviously when the physicality gets introduced and the pads come on. But I'll say this, go watch the tape. He was never shy about laying the wood in college. Why would we expect that's going to change now that he's in the NFL? He's big enough. He's strong enough. He's a great athlete. So interesting to see what Darian Porter, what he's capable of doing this year. But I want your thoughts, 702-365-9200. Call us, text us. What are your expectations for the Raiders rookie class? We're going to be talking to Howard Balzer. We're going to be talking to Trister Crick. We want to talk to you about what we're talking about. Give us a call, 702-365-9200.
We're back to the JT the Brick Show with your host for today, Vinny Bonsignor, only on Raider Nation Radio 920 AM.
You know, obviously the length, that's a positive right there. The speed, that's all stuff that's documented. The thing that I see the most that's, like, that sticks out to me is the combination of his effort and his ability to correct mistakes. So when you have a rookie player coming in first time in the NFL, if you can see the effort, him getting on the same page with how we play, our play style, that's a positive there. And then if he can eliminate the repeat mistakes, you're on the way to, you know, becoming a dependable football player.
As Raiders defensive coordinator Patrick Graham talking about Darian Porter, yeah, he's an intriguing player. There's no question about it. A former wide receiver, first couple of years at Iowa State, transitioned over to cornerback. I give the Iowa State coaching staff a lot of credit because they brought him along at a nice pace. I think, you know, that's one of those you know, programs that, yeah, they want to win football games without question. They do. They get to bowl games year in and year out. Matt Campbell does a fantastic job running that program. But what they also understand is one of their roles for players that they recruit is to get them ready for the NFL. You know, that's part of the whole deal. And when you look at Darian Porter and what Darian Porter was to start out with at Iowa State, and then what he ultimately became, and they didn't just rush him into being a starter or putting him on the field before he was quite ready as a cornerback. It took a little while. In fact, he didn't really start until his last year at Iowa State. But by then, you know, he was ready to really contribute. And here's the thing. You know, when you think about the Tonka Hemingways and the J.J. Pegueses and some of these defensive players that the Raiders drafted, whether it was this year or the last few years, the Jacorian Bennetts, the Darian Porters, guys that they've brought in as free agent, your Jeremy Chins, your Eric Stokes, Landon Roberts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. One thing that has to happen for this defense, and I can't make this any clearer, but one thing that has to happen, and it really goes for both sides of the football, but both sides have to do their job in this one specific area, and that's taking care of the ball and taking the ball away. You know, the seven worst teams in turnover differential were the Browns at minus 22, the Titans at minus 16, the Raiders at minus 16, the Jaguars are at minus 15, the Patriots at minus 11, and the 49ers at minus 10, and the Giants at minus 8. That means you're on the negative side. You're giving the ball up more than you're taking the ball away. And in the Raiders' case, they gave it away 16 more times than they took it away. They weren't even even. They were negative 16 in that regard in the turnover margin. Those teams that I just mentioned, the Browns, the Titans, the Raiders, the Jaguars, the Patriots, the 49ers, and the Giants, and the Raiders were tied for second with the worst turnover differential in the league at negative 16, minus 16. The records of those teams combined, 27 and 92. And the Raiders certainly contributed to that with a 4-13 record. They were 4-13 last year. They had a negative 16, a minus 16 turnover differential. You are not going to win football games. You're going to lose football games. If you can't take care of the ball and you can't take the ball away. And for further proof of that, the 8 best teams in turnover differential, the Buffalo Bills at plus 24, the Pittsburgh Steelers at plus 16, the Green Bay Packers at plus 12, the Chargers at plus 12, the Vikings at plus 12, the Eagles at plus 11, and the Texans at plus 10. Their combined record, 98 and 28. So the 8 worst teams in turnover differential were 27 and 92. Let that sink in for a second. 27 and 92. The 8 teams with the best turnover differential were 98 and 28. That's 16 teams right there. That's more than half of the NFL, or that's exactly half of the NFL. The disparity, the direct correlation between taking care of the ball and protecting the ball versus not could not be more clear. A 27-92 record for the worst eight teams in turnover differential, and a 98-28 record for the best eight. So I can't make it any clearer. Just look at the numbers. And here's where a guy like Darian Porter could play into that. Now, for me, when you look at turnover differential, when you look at creating turnovers, a couple things have to happen. Number one, we go back to, remember the conversation that we had with Eric Allen during minicamp? And, you know, here's a guy that's going to the Hall of Fame. He had, you know, just a ridiculous amount of career interceptions. It was an eye-popping number. I think it was over 50. And I said to him, that just doesn't happen. How does that happen? How do you, nobody's just throwing you the ball that amount of times. The opposing quarterback's not just saying, here, Eric, I'm going to throw you the interception and it's going to happen, you know, this amount of times, a Hall of Fame type number. And what did he talk about? He talked about studying film work. He talked about, watching the routes that players ran opposing. He went to the best wide receivers in the NFL. What are the routes that you're running in every situation? Every situation, first and 10, first and second and 8, whatever the situation was. And he made a book in his mind that, and so that when game time came, he knew exactly what the route was that guys were running based on the situation, based on film work, and was able to take chances. And he said, they're not chances. They're educated guesses based on everything that he had seen on film. Speaking about the Hall of Fame and Eric Allen going to the Hall of Fame, there's no one better to talk about the Hall of Fame, who's going in this year, who might be going in down the road, what contemporary players are on track for the Hall of Fame, than my good friend Howard Balzer. He's now in Phoenix, and he covers the Cardinals and does a fantastic job of that. He's been around the NFL for decades. He always has his pulse or finger on the pulse of everything that's going on, and I can't wait to talk to him about the Cardinals, about the Hall of Fame, about his perceptions of the Raiders. Howard, first of all, thank you so much for joining us, my good friend. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, man. How are you doing? Good to be with you.
Yep, absolutely. Let's stay right there with the Hall of Fame, Eric Allen, the great Raider cornerback, Philadelphia Eagle cornerback, New Orleans Saints cornerback, is going into the Hall of Fame. That's here sooner than we think. At the end of this month, literally, is when he's going to get enshrined, and the Hall of Fame game is going to be played out there in Canton, Ohio. Can you talk a little bit about Eric Allen and this year's class?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was about time that he got in. There always seems to be, we call it guys who fall through the cracks for some reason, and that don't get a lot of discussion or talk early in their eligibility, and then when they're not a finalist or sometimes not even a semifinalist for several years, they kind of get a little bit forgotten about. And I think that happened with Eric. He was certainly Hall of Fame worthy. There's always a lot of different opinions and reasons, and people wonder why it took so long, but it's happened with a bunch of other players. And he finally started getting traction in the last few years. And sometimes, Vinny, what it takes is someone, you know, I mean, we receive stuff from fans and, you know, all the time about this guy should be in, that guy should be in, or whatever. But what can help sometimes is when a player's cause is taken up by a selector and it's communicated to the rest of the group, hey, we need to take a closer look at this guy. And then when you get someone like Eric, who is nearing the end of his modern day eligibility, it becomes even more of an issue in terms of hoping to get somebody in, because once they fall into that seniors group, which we call the seniors abyss, it gets even harder to get in. And so it was good for him that he got in, very strong class this year. Although in my mind, it's a class that is too small because of changes that were made by the Hall of Fame in the process, which I kind of question of why they did it. And so there's only total four players going in, including three modern day guys, when in the past two decades, there have been five modern day guys that get in each year. So the other two modern day guys, of course, Antonio Gates from the Chargers in his second year of eligibility, and pass rusher Jared Allen, who had been a finalist several years before that. And then a guy who really fell through the cracks, probably because of a short career ended by injury, was Sterling Sharp, who went in as the seniors candidate. And only one candidate from the three seniors, one coach and one contributor that were finalists, he's the only one that got in because of this change in the Hall of Fame process, which they're not going to change for 2026. And I hope that it doesn't happen the same way that it did. But when you start limiting the classes, you just make it harder and harder down the road for other guys to come in, especially those guys who have been finalists 5, 6, 7 times, who just keep waiting year after year.
All right, so let's stay right there, Howard, and we're talking to the great Howard Balzer, the longtime NFL writer. He currently covers everything NFL-related, but focused on the Arizona Cardinals, who, by the way, the Raiders will play in the preseason. Looking forward to that. What are the new rules that you're talking about? Because, honestly, I saw the player. I'm on the Hall of Fame page right now. I see Eric. I see Jared. I see Antonio Gates. I see Sterling Sharp. I was literally, Howard, scrolling down because I go, I'm missing somebody. Because it just looks so small. It visually looks small to the point where there has to be some more players. And I realize that's right. It was only 4 players this year. What are the rules that we're talking about here that have changed the dynamic?
Yeah, what ended up happening is, and it kind of reversed everything that had been happening for a long time. And I'll start with the seniors committee, because in 10 years ago, a separate contributors category was created, so those people wouldn't get considered with modern day players. Then, after the centennial class of 2020, they made the coaching category separate, and then a couple years after that, they increased the number of potential seniors to go in to 3, and then those 5, whoever it was, would be voted on after discussion, yes or no on all 5. And so sometimes all 5 would get in, sometimes 4 or 5, but it was always more than one. Well, then this year what they did was, for some unknown reason, they reversed all those decisions. And of those 5, let me backtrack for a minute. Usually, well, I'll stay with that, because instead of voting yes or no on each of those 5, the committee voted for 3 of those 5.
Hmm.
And then to get elected, you had to get 80% of the vote. So anyone with any kind of mathematical background would know when you start doing that, votes start getting split, and it's very hard for some of them to get 80%.
Wow.
And so Sterling Sharp was the only one to get 80.
Hmm.
And 2 other seniors guys didn't get in. Mike Holmgren, the coaching finalist, did not get in. And so that was the situation there. With the modern day guys, in the past, what it had always been was you have 15 finalists. There'd be an initial reduction to 10. And then a reduction to 5, at which point all 5 would be voted on individually again, yes or no. And what happened over the previous 2 decades was that all of the 5 would be elected. And one of the reasons is because everyone realized, even if someone felt, well, I'm not sure he's a Hall of Fame or whatever, but everyone realized that if one of the 5 did not get 80%, guess what? He was coming back next year in the finals. And then that kept someone else out of the final 15, someone from advancing who maybe hadn't been there before.
Wow.
Well, this year they changed that, and the reduction, instead of from 10 to 5, was 10 to 7. And then the committee voted for 5 of those 7. And once again, there were split votes. And the other 4 players in the top 7 were Torrey Holt. I can remember them all.
Oh, yeah.
Torrey Holt, longtime tackle with the Bengals, Willie Anderson, and 2 first-time eligible guys, Adam Vinatieri and Luke Kuechly. Well, none of those 4 guys got the 80%. And so here we are with only 3 modern-day guys going in. And, Vinny, when you look at the numbers, consider this. You have 3 guys elected. 12 will likely come back as the 15 finalists for next year. So there's only three other spots. And then you have a first-time eligible class in 2026 that includes Drew Brees, Larry Fitzgerald, and there's some other really top players in there. So, again, it becomes very, very more you know, in one respect, there are those who are saying, well, the Hall of Fame should be hard to get in. My argument was it was already hard.
Yes.
You know, why make it? Yet, why make it even harder? And so that's what they did. And, you know, we'll see where it goes from there. And they wanted, by the way, they wanted to make that 80% vote sacrosanct, but they also had a minimum. There had to be a minimum of one from that five-person seniors coach committee to get in, and there had to be a minimum of three modern-day guys. Well, guess what? Suppose only two guys got 80%.
Right.
Guess what? The third one is going to get in with less than 80%. So all of a sudden they're saying that 80% is sacrosanct, but acknowledging that someone might get in without getting 80%. So I many of us didn't understand it. We've had debates about it. They're not changing it this year. And I said, at least if you're going to do it this way, have the minimum be 2 and 4.
Right.
And at least have a minimum of a 6-person class. But that won't be the case in 2026 unless there's a last minute change. And we'll see what happens next year.
Well, let's see. Let's hope that that cooler heads prevail or smarter heads prevail, and that does get changed, because that's ridiculous. All right, we'll set aside the frustration in the Hall of Fame because it drives me nuts for a little while at least. We've got a season to play now. Thankfully, Howard, we're talking to the great Howard Balzer, the great NFL writer, and he covers the Arizona Cardinals, and that's where I want to focus right now. Howard, it feels like the Cardinals have been in perpetual rebuild for a little while now. Kind of reminds me of a team that I cover. I think there's reason for optimism here in Las Vegas with Pete Carroll and everything that's going on with the Raiders. I want to say the same for the Cardinals, but I'm still a little bit, you know, skeptical on this. And to me, it starts with their quarterback, Kyler Murray. I want to love Kyler Murray, Howard. I really do. This was a guy that was a fabulous college football player. He's shown flashes of brilliance in the NFL. There's times, heck, out here, he took over a game against the Raiders in an infamous loss that the Raiders suffered in overtime a couple of years ago. What has held Kyler Murray back? Because it feels like over the last few years, younger quarterbacks have kind of lapped him a little bit, and we sort of forget now about Kyler Murray. What's been holding him back?
It's a great question, because there's a lot of layers to it.
Mm-hmm.
And a big part of it, when you go back to two pretty successful years where they stumbled late in the season, especially the 2022 season,
yep.
The 2021 season,
okay,
when they started 7-0,
yes,
and then were 10-2, and then, you know, crashed at the end of the year, winning only one of their final games, and then just getting, you know, blown out by the Rams in a wild card playoff game. But Kyler Murray, in 2 years, 2020, when they looked pretty good, had stumbled at the end. He was playing injured with a shoulder injury,
mm-hmm,
and then with an ankle injury in 2021, and he wasn't the same player as he had been prior to those injuries when he was on the field. There were other aspects around him that were affected. That 2021 season, DeAndre Hopkins, the number one threat at receiver, was injured and didn't play a bunch near the end of the season. So that certainly affected him. Then, of course, he suffers a torn ACL in 2022 and then comes back, you know, halfway through the 2023 season, when it was pretty bad, and that was Jonathan Gannon's first year as head coach. Well, then last year he played all 17 games, and while he was still dealing with some residuals from the ACL surgery, he didn't suffer any new injuries, and he had his moments. The team had its moments. They were 6-4 after the bye. Or at the bye, I should say, and then once again stumbled at the end of the season. And, of course, the easiest thing to lay it on is, well, Kyler Murray didn't play well, and that's why they lost those games. And certainly he contributed to that. But they also had, you know, other issues. There were injuries on the offensive line. He didn't really get on the same page as Marvin Harrison Jr. for most of the season, even though Harrison's numbers were solid, if not spectacular, which were the expectations. And then their defense, which was improved and better last year, in the last five, in five of the losses in the last seven games, they were -7 in turnover ratio. And most of that was because they didn't get takeaways. And they only had 17 as a team for the entire season. So I think Murray, with the right cast around him and that support, plus a better defense that can take the ball away and put your offense where you don't have to go 70, 80 yards all the time, will hopefully make them a better team. And so I think that's been the big thing that, you know, that happened with him. And he has to, you know, make those plays near the end. And he's done it at times, making those big plays at the end of games to help your team win. But then there's been some other ones where he would, you know, he'd throw one of those ones where you scratch your head and you go, what was that pass all about? It'd be intercepted.
Mm-hmm.
But of course he was pressured and the offensive line didn't have consistent protection of him. And so that's been an issue at times. You know, last year they were playing without their starting right guard, Will Hernandez, for the last 12 games of the season. Jonah Williams, who they signed to a relatively big contract to play right tackle, only played 6 games for the entire season. So all of those things, to me, factor in whether a quarterback is successful or not. But there's no doubt the challenge this year, in this third year of the system, for it all to be better, coupled with an improved defense. They did improve by 4 wins last year. They ended up only 2 games out of first place,
right,
in the division. And we'll see if those improvements can come. But, you know, who knows? You know, when they hit the field, that's the big thing, is improving those things that have been an issue over the last few seasons. But to me, it never is on one person's shoulders, even though a lot of people like to, when a team doesn't go well,
yeah,
especially on offense, it's either the play caller's fault or the quarterback's fault. And then hardly anybody looks at all the other things that go on around that player.
Yeah, I feel like sometimes there's excuses and sometimes there's valid explanations. And I feel like in his case, there's valid explanations why it hasn't necessarily translated. Some of it was outside of his control, the injuries and the supporting cast. All right, real quick, Howard, you cover the Cardinals. You've covered the NFC West now for a long time. That means you've covered the Seattle Seahawks as well, or peripherally as an opponent of the Cardinals, and before that, the Rams. So you know a lot about Pete Carroll and a little bit also about Geno Smith. As you look over here in this direction to Las Vegas and you see Pete Carroll and you see Geno Smith and you see the changes that the Raiders have made, what do you feel like the perception is, whether it's you or how some of you and your national colleagues, when they look at the Raiders, what is that perception right now?
Yeah, I think it's the unknown right now. And certainly getting Pete Carroll is a plus for them also, because it's a quality leader, you know, a guy who's certainly is 73 years old, but doesn't act like he's 73. But the quarterback play is obviously key for every team. And he has that experience with Geno Smith, so that can be crucial. It's obviously developing all the things around him with the targets and the line and all those things that have to be better. But in that division that the Raiders are in, oh my goodness, you look at the head coaches in that division, all of them, you know, with the wins they have with Harbaugh and Andy Reid and Sean Payton, the competition is incredible. And so that's going to make it tough, you know, for the Raiders. But I think there's reason for some optimism, but obviously a lot of it's going to lie on Geno Smith and how much can the defense continues to improve for them to be consistently competitive with those other teams in that division.
Yeah, I agree. Howard, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Look forward to regrouping in August when the Raiders head to your neck of the woods to play them in the last preseason game. We'll double back to you at that point. Always a great pleasure. Thank you so much. Enjoy the last week before the madness begins, and look forward to you talking down the road, man.
Sounds good, Vinny. Take care.
You got it. That's Howard Balzer. He's been around a long, long time. If you remember the draft back in the day, Howard was right there on the ESPN set calling those early drafts. I can remember them vividly. This was long before they were in prime time. It was early in the morning. I used to have to wake up really early. I would always call in sick to school. My dad would let me do that. And I would watch the draft at 9 a.m. Pacific time, all day event in the middle of the week. Thanks to Howard Balzer. 702-365-9200. Let us know what you think is the expectations of this Raiders rookie class.